Well, Dad, I'm glad you're here with me on God Quest today. And we're going to have a great discussion. I think it's going to be very interesting. I'm personally looking forward to it. I've been looking forward to it all week, knowing we were going to do it. And it's kind of swinging the other way. Last week, our last episode, we talked about Gen Z and all of the opportunities this young generation has yes. at their disposal. And I know you watch that anytime your grandson's on. I'm sure you're paying attention. But we're going to swing the other way. And I want to go back some generations. And I want to go to your generation, but I don't want to just go to your generation. I want to go back to the generation before you.
I see.
Of men that impacted you. Your generation represents, for us, they were the heroes that oftentimes when I was a young man, a teenager, coming up in the ministry, your generation were the elders that we were looking to. Some of the men like Marvin Treese, a little older, obviously, was Brother G.A. Mangan, and that generation of men, your generation. Who are some of the men that were your peers that maybe Gen Z doesn't know a lot about? I'm thinking of one, R.E. Johnson.
Yes.
That was, I remember as a kid, he would preach for us a lot. So tell the audience a little bit about R.E. Johnson.
Well, actually, Brother Johnson was a confidant of mine. He came out of the same church that my dad came out of, Brother Robert LaFleur's in Oakdale, California, Louisiana.
Oakdale, yeah.
And
there is an Oakdale, California.
Yes, I got mixed up on that. Because Brother
Johnson
was so close to my dad, that brought him close to me.
Okay.
And I preached for him, and then after I became a pastor, he preached many times for us.
I remember.
And he was a confidant.
Yeah.
I could go to Brother Johnson and ask him a question. If I was dealing with something, he helped me. He talked to me. He helped me so much, and he was a great man.
He was a revivalist preacher.
Yes.
I remember there was an energy and excitement.
That's right.
He was a powerful preacher. I remember him coming through. I recently came across online. I don't even remember where it was. Someone had messages of him, audio files on the internet, and so it was a like a breath of fresh air. I had not heard his voice in so long. He pastored in Georgia.
Yes, for a
yeah.
while.
Yeah.
But he pastored also in Louisiana.
Okay. I don't remember that. I just remember when he was in Georgia when I was a younger man. Then there were men like Marvin Treese, a scholar
yes.
among scholars.
Yes.
You were very close to
yes.
Dr. Treese.
Yes. Brother Treese was a close friend. And I would say that he impacted me more than anyone during the years that I pastored in Baton Rouge.
Which is interesting because he was a peer.
Yes.
And as a peer, did you have the respect for him? Did you guys recognize the greatness of Marvin Treese while he was alive? Sometimes it's we can overlook the greatness in our friends.
Yes, brother Treese was well respected. He was.
Even by his peers.
That's right. He came once a year for, I don't even remember how many years he did this. He came and preached a prophecy conference at our church. And that's where I learned a lot of things about prophecy.
I've heard you say that many times in telling stories about the influence of Brother Treese upon your theology and eschatology. Was that happening while he was preaching for you, or was that happening in discussions, relationship? How did that happen?
Both. I would go to his house and talk to him, and he even came to Baton Rouge and talked with me, spent a lot of time together. Brother Treese was a really good friend and loyal.
Brother Treese, along with a number of other men, I'm remembering as a young man growing up, there was what was called the Pure Gold Conference.
Yes.
There were a number of you, Brother Treese, Brother Fred Foster, yourself, Brother Allen, Galen Allen, who was in Westlake at that time. I remember that conference, and Brother Treese. I remember those meetings. Some were in Baton Rouge, some were in Lake Charles, and the impact that they had on me as a young man, hearing Brother Treese. And I remember Brother Treese would come. That was before technology, and he would have a big handmade charts, and then his son Brother Rick Treese would come, and maybe a couple other guys, and they would be kind of his assistants. And I remember hearing and watching, just amazed.
Yes.
But I'll tell you what was fun to me was after church, that was in the days when preachers went to the house. You know, there wasn't as many restaurant options. And I remember just sitting around. I didn't even know half of what y'all were talking about. But I remember those discussions around the dinner table late into the night. How much of those kind of encounters shaped your ministry?
Absolutely. It impacted me so much. Brother Treese was not only a great preacher. He was a man. And he was a friend. We didn't always talk about scripture and prophecy, but he was very, very outspoken and was kind and taught me a lot of things.
He was a brilliant mind. I remember one of the last times I ever saw him alive, I had preached for his son, Brother Rick Treese, and after church, the three of us went to a restaurant, and I remember him just sitting there, and I was trying to he was up in years, and I could tell he had had a lot of back issues and surgeries, and those are memories I cherish. You have a unique thing of ministry in that your dad was a pastor, a church planter, as well as a missionary.
That's
Greece,
right.
India, Philippines, Australia, maybe somewhere else. I can't even keep up with Papa. And the Fields Church. How many stories did I hear of Fields, Louisiana, you telling? Tell a little bit about what happened with your dad taking this little handful of people in this little country place called Fields. Unpack that for me.
Well, actually, my dad had been pastoring in West Texas, and he felt like going back to Louisiana. So we moved to Louisiana, and for a little while we lived with one of my dad's uncles. And then two churches came open. One was a church that was self-supporting for a pastor. And the other church it was an older church, one of the oldest churches in the state of Louisiana. But it was very small. It had three adult people and no children in the church.
So the church had
three adults, and that's all it was to the church. That was at Fields.
I guess, and it was wide open.
And Dad said God wanted me to go to Fields, and it proved to be true, because it was not but a couple of years, maybe even not as long as that he was running 150 to 200 people. And we had to move out of the building and go outside and string up electrical lines outside for the people to take care of the crowd. The whole community came out, and we had a great revival in Fields. I think our highest attendance was maybe 244 or somewhere along that line.
Wow.
And
that would have been in the late 40s, early 50s?
The early 50s.
Early 50s. So that would have been one of the larger churches, 240 people, I would think, in that time.
Well, we didn't actually run 240 people, but that was a high attendance on a Sunday, one particular time.
Wow. I have in my office, I have a picture that was given to me by the family of that revival and that little church. There was no way that crowd could even get in the building.
That's
that
right.
is is there, and those lights that had been strung to those pine trees around the church. What an incredible heritage there that I have, that I value deeply, and the ministry of your mom and dad, not only in the United States, but around the world. And a lot of incredible stories that we could go into. Another very unique thing is one of the heroes of your generation and my generation, that y'all would look to, was the great J.T. Pugh.
That's right.
One of the greatest men of God. I'm so thankful, looking back, that I had the privilege of spending personal time with him as well as hearing him. But you have the uniqueness. There was a connection with your call to preach with him, and then your ministry later on. So tell us about, what's the connection you had with J.T. Pugh?
Well, my first encounter with him was when I was very young. He preached a youth camp in Louisiana. And I went to that youth camp, and one particular night, his subject was the master's minority. And before he preached, he had the ushers to distribute to all of the campers a little form to fill out. And when he preached his sermon, then he invited all of the kids to go down to the altar and fill that little form out. And fold that and put it in their Bible.
And was it like a commitment of what you were going to do?
That's right. And it was while I was filling that out around the altar, I felt like God was calling me to preach.
Wow.
Now, there had been people in Dad's church that said, Curtis, you're going to be a preacher. But I resisted it. I didn't feel anything. But that night, I really felt the call to preach. And to this day, I still have that little form somewhere. And
here you are, 84 years old, and you still remember the name of the sermon. So it was an impacting moment.
Oh, yes, yes.
Now, J.T. Pugh, that wasn't the end of the story with you and J.T. Pugh. There was a meeting. You were somewhere, and there's something else that happened with J.T. Pugh. Talk about that.
Well, I was preaching a revival in Cleveland, Texas, for Brother McNeely.
Okay.
And I was in his office one Saturday, and I was preparing for Sunday, and there came a knock on the door, and I looked out the window, and it was Brother J.T. Pugh, and I was shocked because I had no personal connection with him that time. And so he said, Brother Young, when I opened the door, he said, Brother Young, I want to come in and talk with you. I said, okay. So he came in, and he said he had just spent some time with Brother Kilgore, and he said, I need an assistant. And Brother Kilgore recommended me to come and talk to you and ask you, would you be willing? And I, without praying about it, I just simply said, absolutely.
Well, my Lord, it's J.T. Pugh. Yeah.
And I was engaged to be married at that point. And he said it was close to Christmas time. And he said, now I want you to get there before Christmas because my family and I are going on a Christmas vacation. And I want you to take care of the church while I'm gone.
Is this the famous watch night service?
Yes.
Okay. Tell this. Let's break in the spiritual story. This is a very funny story to me. I can't even imagine this happening. Was it the New Year's Eve service?
They were gone through Christmas till after the New Year's Day. And so Brother Pugh had said to me, he said, there's a watch night that takes place. Said we start at 8 o'clock and we end at 5 minutes after midnight.
So you got to produce
And he said,
four-hour service.
You can have testimonies, you can have special songs, but he said, and you can preach, but he said, go on until 5 minutes after 12.
Had you not been there before?
No, I hadn't.
This is your first assignment.
Yes. So, sure enough, New Year's Eve, we started at 8:30, and I had people to sing. I had testimonies. I preached a sermon, and we prayed, but the prayer was getting very, very small. And so finally, I said to the people, I said, we're going to do a little different thing right now.
It's your first assignment.
We're going to dismiss you right now, and I want you to go home, and I want you to pray in your house until 5 minutes after midnight.
So this is the church's introduction to you, your introduction to the church. J.T. Pugh leaves you. He was quite the prankster.
Yes.
I've heard you tell stories of going on hospital visitation and he opened the door and direct you in and then closed the door behind you, and you were in the janitor's closet at the hospital.
Yeah.
He was quite a character.
Yeah.
And I will never forget, I was riding in the car with you and him one time. I was a young man, and he turned very seriously. And here's the great J.T. Pugh. And I was, you know, enamored, just sitting in the back seat, just hanging on every word that you and he were speaking about. And he turned to me and he said, "Brother Miles, don't ever let them cut your head off." And it was so shocking. I said, "Okay." He said, "Two reasons." I said, "Okay." He said, "Number one, you'll be much shorter. And number two, you'll have nowhere to put your hat." And then turn back around.
That's just like Brother Pugh.
And so I'm forever caught between this, the great icon of faith ministry, J.T. Pugh, and the prankster that just knew how to make you laugh. These are memories that I cherish, and you've got memories with him. You mentioned you were engaged to be married. You were engaged to Mom, who was at a church in Houston. She was the choir director, and her best friend was the organ player. And you and Uncle Simeon showed up somehow or another, and y'all wound up falling in love with the choir director and the piano player and Brother Foss's church. And you married and took the choir director and the piano player out.
And Brother Foss told us this was the most expensive revival he'd ever had.
So talk about Orland Ray Foss. He was a preacher of preachers.
Yes, yes.
So he was Mom's pastor. Tell about the relationship you had with him. He's a name that maybe hasn't been as well known to a younger generation, but in my life, I remember him preaching at Louisiana camp meeting and other conferences and revivals. Dad, he could preach hell so hot you could feel your feet were on fire.
Yes, Brother Foss was a conviction preacher. I remember one time when I was pastoring in North Carolina, I was the youth president of the district, and Brother Foss came to preach our youth camp. And every night, the altar would fill up before he gave the altar call. So one night, he told the congregation before he started preaching, he said, "I don't want anybody coming to the altar until I give you the sign and tell you to come to the altar." And he preached a message on hell. And I want to tell you, that whole place, adults and campers, everybody in that youth camp was weeping. And when he said, "Come to the altar," they rushed to the altar. And it just filled that whole place with the conviction that had come on them. Mm. Brother Foss was one of the greatest preachers I ever heard.
I had the privilege of hearing him many times, obviously because of the family connection there and stayed in their home. But one of my prized possessions that you gave me a number of years ago, you went back for an anniversary service. Brother David Foss, the pastor there now and district superintendent in Texas there. And you brought back a gift from the church of messages by Orland Ray Foss at his home church. Dad, I have listened to those messages, and I have thought to myself, it's unbelievable that a man could bring week after week after week that depth. And I try, I study, I pray, I try to get the mind of God. But there was something very, very unique and powerful about the ministry of Orland Ray Foss.
Yes.
What a And again, you mentioned one of them being a man's man, Brother Treese. Orland Ray Falls was a man's man.
Yes.
And I enjoy thinking of so many of the memories that I share because of being in your home and the connection there. You also had a friend that came to our home, preached in our pulpit, that is highly revered even by a younger generation, Brother T.W. Barnes.
Yes.
You know, sometimes we look back with memories, but if you'll go revisit a message of some of these men that we forget how good of preachers they were. I was listening to Brother N.A. Urshan the other day, and I was just driving down the road, and I'm thinking, man, I had forgotten how powerful a preacher he was. And the same was true of Brother Barnes. There's a lot of material out there you can listen to and watch. And I remember one particular night he came to preach in Baton Rouge on a Sunday night. You and I had been to the hospital to visit someone. That was before cell phones. We got home and Mom had said, hey, Brother Barnes called. He's going to be in town tonight. And I knew you'd want him to preach. So he said, I told him you'd want him to preach. He said, sure. Well, we got to church that night and Brother Barnes wasn't there, but you announced, folks, Brother Barnes is going to be coming in and he's going to be preaching. Everybody clapped, you know, and then I was leading the choir. We got to the choir and Brother Barnes still wasn't there and you motioned, sing another one. And so that was kind of the days we didn't have these big long rehearsals. We just kind of went to another song and I kept doing the chorus again, but Brother Barnes still wasn't there. And then finally, I ended the choir song and there was another Brother Simpkins was there who was a presbyter visiting family in the church. And he was there and you turned to him. And I'll never forget Brother Simpkins took the pulpit and you as he took it, you had said, now folks, Brother Barnes, I never really talked to him because I was at the hospital when he called earlier and I thought he was going to be here, but something has come up. But Brother Simpkins here, he's going to preach it. Brother Simpkins took the pulpit. And as he was about to read his text, Brother Barnes walked in. And it never ceases to amaze me when I relive this story, is that God had worked all of that around so that the church knew that you had never had one conversation with Brother Barnes. And when Brother Barnes stepped and preached that night, I remember he preached Footprints in the Sands of Time.
That's right.
And he began to walk the floor, and there was a situation that was going on in the church, and I remember it well. And I remember the people involved. I was just a young man and finding my way. And I remember he walked off the platform down the right side of that church, the Victorious Church on Victoria Drive. And he walked down that side. And as he was preaching, he pointed right at the, he never called the man's name, but he pointed his finger right at the man and he dealt with the issue. And that man repented and made everything right. And I have relived that moment so many times, knowing that there was no way that any other thing except the perfect will of God happened in that service as Brother T.W. Barnes. And these were men that you rubbed shoulders with almost on a daily and weekly basis.
Brother Barnes was really a man of God. I had the opportunity of preaching two revivals for him. One when I was very young, and then after I left Baton Rouge, he wanted me to come to his church, and I preached another revival. He was an amazing man. And the night you were speaking about, I really believe God orchestrated that exactly like it happened, so the church would know that I had not told Brother Barnes anything.
Yeah, it was a moment that I will never forget. It was so poignant and it was so supernatural that you could have heard a pin drop. It was like, because that issue was had moved through the congregation.
Yes.
I remember it well. You were also friends with another great man of God, and we'll just kind of wrap up with this and we'll come back and talk about some more people another time. But Brother Verbal Bean, one of the great men of God that we revere in our memory. And I never had the chance to hear him personally, but you've got some connections that go way back even to his early ministry. Am I correct?
That's right. Brother Bean lived in a community about 15 to 20 miles from where Dad was pastoring.
Okay.
And Dad was pastoring at Fields at that time. And Brother Bean's grandfather came to our church, and his daughter Brother Bean's sister was a member of our church, and she was Sunday school teacher in one of the classes that I was in at Sunday school. And that's how I came to know Brother Verbal Bean. We saw him quite often. And incidentally, he preached his very first revival for Dad at Fields. And so
there's a lot going on in Fields.
Yes.
So who would have ever thought that from these humble places, looking back, J.T. Pugh, raised in poverty, Brother Foss pastored in Shady Grove. Shady Grove's still not a very big, it's just a spot in the road outside of Gina. You've got Brother R.E. Johnson and Brother Barnes from Minden. These are not big metropolises with big cathedrals and seminaries. These were humble places that were often maybe even rural, but God's hand reached down and anointed these men. And coming out, you look at some of the places like Oakdale and DeQuincy and DeRidder, Louisiana, out of that Elton, Louisiana revival that sprung out of Arroyo Seco, right, as the Jesus name. The power that came out of that Louisiana, East Texas conglomerate of apostolic churches that are still there. People today see all the churches, but they don't really even understand the power of what was developing way, way back in those days. Dad, I really appreciate you coming on today, and maybe this has shed some light and maybe told a new generation. Last week we talked about Gen Z, but now we're looking back at an incredible generation of ministry, and I count a high privilege to be able to share these stories. And there may be somebody watching that this is going to spur them to go watch or listen to. Let me just tell you, these men were powerful.
Yes.
And if we can just scratch the surface of what these great men and others did, what a testimony. And Dad, you've impacted so many people. You've impacted me. And I have the privilege of working alongside of you. Here it is, 2024, to be able to go that far back to men like J.T. Pugh and Verbal Bean and Orlin Ray Foss. That connection is there. And it's a generational thing that I want to get all the way to Gen Z. Because if they get a little touch of that, they can impact their world.
And I look at this generation that's with us right now, and I'm amazed at how great they are doing. And I thank God for them.
Well, I think that about says it all right there.
Yeah.
Let's do this.
Okay.